me back in Manitoba many moons ago. And it must be Sunday. You know how I know? Because there's the theme for Abandoned Manitoba. And once again, I'm joined by Gordon Goldsborough of the Manitoba Historical Society. Good morning.
Good morning, Nadja.
So you wrote us a very eloquent, should I say, sonnet?
Well,
poem?
I'm not sure I'd go.
Something.
I wouldn't go so far as that, but it was at least a simple rhyme.
It rhymed. The words rhymed.
That's about
us
the best I can do.
I'll take it.
And then the idea was that last week, of course, we talked about meat processing in rural Manitoba, and I said that this week we would not look at meat, but something sweet that could not be beat.
Love it, Manitoba. I hope you've been processing that for the past week.
There's a good one, too, because in fact, we are going to talk about beets, actually.
Okay.
More specifically, sugar beets.
Okay. So I had no idea that Manitoba, I mean, this is a common theme in our conversations. I had no idea that this happened in Manitoba.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
Well, that's right, because sugar beets are something that in the past we grew a lot of. Some part of southern Manitoba, especially if you drove south from Winnipeg through to the U.S. border, you would have seen lots of fields filled with sugar beets. It was a very major crop at one time. It's not anymore, unfortunately, but there's the story. So let's look a little bit at the sugar beet. The beet itself is a very close relative of the common garden beet. In fact, they're the same species, what scientists call Beta vulgaris. The only reason they're different is that over the years, people have gradually, through breeding, increased their sugar production. See, most beets and other sort of ground vegetables like them have a very high starch content in their roots. And starch is something that is, it is sugar, as starch is, but it's not something that tastes sweet to our tongue. And so apparently through time, breeders have increased the sugar content of the sugar beet version and so that it was a very high content. So anywhere from like 12% to as much as 20% of the sugar beet is what we call sucrose, which is table sugar.
Okay.
Yeah. So people began looking at the sugar beet to see whether, you know, is a crop that could be developed for Manitoba. We have the right kind of climate. We have the right kind of soil from about the U.S. border to as far north as Toulon in the Interlake, from maybe Steinbach on the east out through Portage la Prairie in the west. That regional area is ideally suited to growing sugar beets.
So that's what I was surprised at, because when I think sugar, I think sugar cane, I think tropical climate. So that's what kind of turned my attention to this.
Exactly. See, that's the thing. Sugar beets, unlike sugar cane, grow well in temperate climates like we have here. In fact, the major countries in the world that grow sugar beets are places like Russia, Germany, the United States, France. These are all sort of temperate countries. Mm. They aren't tropical places. If you think of the sorts of sugar cane that some places in the world use as their source of sugar, well, that's typically a sort of a subtropical or tropical crop. So that's what made the sugar beet so attractive, that if you are worried about the supply of sugar, you know, coming from a very great distance away, like if you're making sugar cane sugar, you know, you don't make it in Manitoba. So you have to therefore transport the sugar from a long ways away. And what really brought this to a head, they had tried growing sugar beets in the early 20th century here in Manitoba, but you need a processing facility. So what really brought it to a head was that in the 1930s, specifically the late 1930s, of course, you saw the rise of the Nazis in Germany. There was a real worry that the war was on the horizon. And in that case, they might jeopardize the shipping that would have to occur to transport this tropical sugar. So they began thinking, you know, maybe it would make sense for us to have a local sugar facility that we don't have to depend on this transportation. You know, if those Nazi submarines start sinking all of our sugar ships, you know, where do we get our sugar from? This could be a real problem for us. So in 1939, a couple of wealthy industrialists from Europe, one, in fact, who had escaped from Nazi-controlled Germany, decided to invest in a plant here in Winnipeg to process sugar beets. 1939, the farmers in Manitoba were all encouraged to adopt this. So a whole bunch of them in the area that I defined there started growing it experimentally in 1939. So the idea is they would have initially a crop ready to process in the early part of 1940. So they started building a plant. The area they chose was an area that at the time was called the municipality of Fort Garry, which is, of course, now part of Winnipeg, on the south side of the city. They started building a great big processing plant to process these sugar beets that were coming in. John Bracken, who was the premier of Manitoba, broke ground in January of 1940 on what they predicted was going to be a $2 million plant. I mean, that's a lot of money by 1940 standards. And it was ready to operate by middle of 1940, so they had all these beets that had been grown experimentally the previous year. Then the farmers, of course, began bringing in the ones from the 1940 crop year in the fall of 1940. So the first bags of locally produced sugar appeared on the Winnipeg grocery store shelves in October of 1940. So everybody, you know, celebrated that now we didn't have to worry if those Nazis cut off our sugar supply, that we'll have lots of locally produced sugar made right here in Manitoba.
Right.
And the farmers that were involved, there was several hundred farmers that began growing sugar beets in earnest. They formed an association that they called the Sugar Beet Growers Cooperative Association of Manitoba, and they began delivering sugar beets. Now, initially, they would bring them with sort of either a horse-drawn wagon or maybe a truck to a loading spot where they would be loaded onto a rail car, sort of an open hoppered rail car. And there's all kinds of places all over southern Manitoba where they would load these cars up. Later, in the later years, they would use trucks. And probably a lot of Winnipeggers have recollections of those big sugar beet trucks coming into Winnipeg, because a lot of them would drop some of the sugar beets on the ground. And I know my wife mentioned that when she was a kid, her parents would make her run out and grab these sugar beets that had fallen on the road. Well, because they had rabbits, and the rabbits loved eating sugar beets. So they would pick up these lost sugar beets to take home for their rabbits.
I love that.
Anyway, so these rail cars or these trucks with sugar beets would come into Winnipeg to this plant in Fort Garry. They would initially store them in either great, great big outdoor piles, or they would later have them in a big sort of a covered warehouse. And the first step in processing them was to slice them. Well, first to wash them, of course. Mm-hmm. Then to slice them into thin sort of noodle-like strips that they called cassettes. And then these thin strips, the reason they were thin is that you wanted to make maximal contact when you put them into hot water. Now, the idea, of course, we know that sugar will dissolve in hot water. So by putting these cassettes into the hot water, it would dissolve the sugar from them. You get this sort of sugary liquid then, which you would then compress. You'd squeeze tightly to press the sugary water out of them. And you get sort of an amber-colored liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And this amber-colored liquid, of course, contains a lot of the sugar. Now, I haven't tasted the sugar water. It comes from sugar beets. But I have from sugar cane, and it's wonderful stuff. Mm-hmm. It tastes almost like pancake syrup, you know, very nice and sweet, sort of caramelly, very delicious.
Yeah.
They would take this, and then through a series of steps, it was a big process, and that's why the building that they built was such a large building to do all this processing. They would evaporate some of the water out, make it thicker, this syrup. They would filter it. They would use a centrifuge, a big device that would spin it rapidly, and that would produce fine white crystals of these of the sugar would come out of this amber liquid. And then they would take that, they would dry it out because it was moist, they would cool it, they'd run it through a screen to kind of make it of even size particles, and there you have it. There you have your finished sugar. But they weren't finished with the liquid either, because they had more sugar content, so they would take it through three extractions to make the most amount of sugar. And then what they had left after all of that was sort of this thick, tarry substance called molasses.
Mm-hmm.
And even, in fact, that molasses was useful because they would take – well, in fact, the entire beet was, in fact, useful because the pulp that was left over from these cassettes would be used to make pellets for feed for livestock. The molasses was used also for feeding livestock, but even used a little bit of that molasses, they would add it back to the white sugar to make brown sugar.
Okay, so they were really getting their money's worth.
Absolutely.
From these babies.
I mean, it was very efficient, this
very
operation
efficient.
To use this whole thing. Now, the process, though, of making this sugar had an associated odor.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet you that listeners will recall, anyone who lived in the Fort Garry area during that time will probably have various descriptions of that smell. I asked around when I was preparing for this episode what you would describe the smell as. And I had various suggestions. One person said described it as sickeningly sweet. Another person said molasses gone bad. A third one I thought was quite interesting, quite descriptive, burnt rhubarb.
Okay.
Which think, oh, I'm not even sure what I know what burnt rhubarb is.
Well, now we can find out.
Yeah, well, in fact, if you want to remind yourself or if you want to judge for yourself, I would suggest if you're ever driving south on Interstate 29 in North Dakota between Grand Forks and Fargo, on the east side of the interstate highway, there is a sugar beet plant operating today. And you can go by there and you can smell it. And then you can say, oh, I go with the burnt rhubarb thing. Anyway, so everything was kind of going well until late 1956 particularly, the controlling interest in this company that operated the plant. The company, by the way, which I hadn't mentioned before, was called the Manitoba Sugar Company. In 1956, it was bought by one of its competitors, the British Columbia Sugar Refining Company, or simply BC Sugar for short. It later operated in Manitoba under the name of one of its subsidiaries, Rogers Sugar. It bought the plant, and the idea was it was going to consolidate and make operations more efficient. Well, in fact, one of the first things they did when they took possession of this plant here in Winnipeg, they decided that they were doing things rather inefficiently. One of the things, for instance, is they were taking the white sugar that they were producing, they were bagging it, but they didn't have any place to store it before they sold it. So they would rent warehouses somewhere in Winnipeg, and they would truck the sugar to those warehouses. And then when they had a buyer, they would truck it back. And they said, well, that's crazy. So they actually built on the site right beside this plant five enormous concrete silos that they could store the sugar right there on the plant and then later ship it out to market. So they built these things, and everything seemed to be going well until the late 1990s. Unfortunately, in 1995, the Canadian government had negotiated what was called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT for short. What that was basically a trade agreement between Canada and the United States. One of the provisions of that GATT was that the United States government was allowed to restrict Canadian exports of sugar-containing products. In other words, they could protect the American sugar producers by keeping out Canadian imports.
Okay.
Well, of course, unfortunately, this was a death blow to the Manitoba plant because their major market, in fact, was the United States. So they no longer had a place to send their sugar. So in January 1997, the plant closed permanently. 82 full-time employees were laid off, but maybe more significantly, 230 sugar beet farmers, you know, who had made their livelihood growing sugar beets for years, decades, were now they had no option for selling their produce, and so the whole industry disappeared. You know, there's the abandonment part. Here was a thriving industry that had been operating for, you know, over 50 years that suddenly, with a stroke of a pen from a trade agreement, closed the plant. So if you go there today, what you see is that the plant building is still there. In fact, blazoned on the side of it in great big white letters, it still says Manitoba Sugar Company. And I remember when I went to look at it, I was like, wow, I didn't think the plant was still operating. And it looked kind of like it was still operating. The big silos that they built are still there. They don't look like they're maybe being used because I think, near as I can tell, the plant is being used now by a metal processing and logistics company. So not as a sugar processor at all. I'd be curious, in fact, to know if there is any vestige of that sugar machinery inside. I'm willing to bet they gutted it, probably took all the machinery out to turn it into something else. So it's sad that this once thriving industry that made locally produced sugar, made right here in Manitoba, is now gone. So if we think about this in the bigger context, today, if we think about where our sugar comes from, we are living increasingly in a global world. And so our food and our sugar, for example, comes to us from far, far away. Today, the only sugar beet growers are in Alberta, in southern Alberta, and in Ontario. And the majority of our sugar here in Manitoba comes from either sugar beets that are grown in southern Alberta and processed at a plant at Taber, Alberta, or possibly even from sugar cane. It's imported from the tropical areas of the world and processed in Vancouver. And then that in turn comes from some tropical area. So we're going almost back to the situation we had way back when. So
I don't know why, but after all of our conversations, you always end up making me feel hungry. Is that intentional?
Well, we've been on the sugar kick for a couple of weeks. But
Well, what about next week? Is there something else on the menu?
Yeah. So this year, the University of Manitoba is celebrating its 140th anniversary. If you visit the grounds of the university campus in South Winnipeg, there is actually a commemorative monument for one of the first six professors that were hired by the university. Now, that's not particularly unusual. What makes this monument, however, unusual is that the professor's remains are inside it.
So, okay, wow.
So next week, I'm going to tell the story of how that professor came to be inside a monument at the University of Manitoba.
Okay, so now we've turned into the Da Vinci Code. You are Winnipeg's Professor Langdon. Just so we know, I cannot wait for this. Thank you so much for joining me.
We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
No. Every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.